Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad that you're here. We have one case that will be argued. And before we begin the arguments, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil. And I'm Bonnie Sutter. I'm the Chief of the Court. I understand that both sides are ready to begin. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Bradley Higgins versus the State of Texas. Please the court. Ms. Andrea Simmons will argue for the appellant, and Mr. Jeffrey Schell will argue for the state.
You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Andrea Simmons, and I am here today on behalf of Mr. Bradley Higgins, appointed defense counsel out of Wise County. We are here today, we've raised three issues in the brief on direct appeal. One being the sufficiency of evidence, two, that the trial court had abused its discretion in denying the motion for new trial, and then three, jury charge error. Starting from the first point of error on the sufficiency of the evidence, appellant, we would concede that there was no objection at the trial court of the untimely filed supplemental notice of extraneous offenses and bad acts in this case. Trial counsel did not object to the supplemental that was filed just one day prior to trial. However, I think it is important to note for purposes of this analysis as well as possible future analysis that could occur as to this issue, that the supplemental notice filed the day before court involved the same defendant, the same victim, and involved pretty much the same allegations that were contained within the state's indictment, and led up to a span of years, including up to 2 days just prior to the offenses that were alleged in the indictment in this case. And there was very little testimony as to the extraneous offenses or notice given as to the jurisdiction of dates of when those offenses occurred or whether those were even in Wise County or the state of Texas when they occurred.
So, and of course, so, you know, the main thrust is that there could have been offenses that fell outside of the statutory range, and your concern is that the jury could have potentially found him guilty for offenses that weren't the actual charged offense. What in the jury charge specifically is lacking in, as far as you are concerned, with reference to that?
Well, I would note that they did include an extraneous offense instruction in the jury charge. But again, because the extraneous offenses and the indicted offenses were so closely aligned as far as the allegations being made, and the evidence was so similar, if not identical, to some of those offenses, that giving limiting instructions at each admission of each of those extraneous offenses at the time they were admitted could have alerted the juror that this is evidence that you have to treat differently. And with the instruction being given as to extraneous offenses at the admission of each of those would have helped tie in the language that limits the jury instruction they received about limiting extraneous offense evidence only as to certain purposes would help qualify for the jury exactly what were the extraneous offenses in this case.
Is your argument dependent upon us finding that the evidence is insufficient that an offense occurred in this January 2019 event?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Is your argument, if we find the evidence is sufficient that an offense was committed in January of 2019, does your argument go away?
I don't believe the argument does. I think it goes away for purposes of direct appeal. But I think, you know, purposes of direct appeal often tie the defense attorney's hands because often the record contains lots of claims that we think would be claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, such as this one, which are then incapable of proving those claims on a direct appeal, absent a motion for new trial, which often the appellate attorney's not in a good position to know what those issues were at trial or receive records in time to raise a motion for new trial. So then we're unable to create the record necessary for direct appeal, and the issue then has to wait until we've completed this process, and if we're unsuccessful, then advising the client, if he cannot afford an attorney, that this is an issue they should raise on direct on a writ of habeas corpus, which often why, especially in case...
Let me stop you. The answer to my question is yes, the argument goes away if we find the evidence is sufficient as to the January 2019. That an offense occurred in January of 2019.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
The issue as to the sufficiency, if this court were to determine that there were sufficient evidence, I think that handles it for this purpose. I think on the writ, they can then claim ineffective for failure to have admitted the extraneous offenses, and I think that very result alone changes the entire sufficiency analysis. So I think it only takes it away at y'all's level, but eventually it would be kicked to the Court of Criminal Appeals for another analysis, I think, based upon the ineffective assistance of counsel.
Issue for another day, another court.
Indeed, indeed, Your Honor. I do believe that issues like that are important to raise, though, however, especially for clients who have been appointed counsel, so are likely to be handling their own writs down the road if they're unable to afford a counsel. So I do like to try to make sure that the record is clear as to those instances of ineffective assistance of counsel that could exist. I also think the court, although they could not rule on it, could take it into consideration in assessing the evidence that was admitted. Considering the evidence and the extraneous offenses, as we must, if we're going to consider even if the evidence was inappropriately admitted, the appellant would still argue that the evidence is insufficient based upon the allegations that rely solely as to the offenses that were alleged in the indictment for the on or about January 3rd, 2019. Although appellant would note that the credibility determinations are to be made by the jury, really the appellant's best argument on that is that the outcry from the victim in this case was not made until well after police had been contacted. He did not tell police of the outcry, but rather about motives unrelated to an offense of why he did not like the appellant and wanted him out of his home and wanted him, quote, gone from their home. And then thereafter, after not telling police about an offense, later outcried as to the allegations in this case to friends of the family as well as the forensic interviewer. However, much of the evidence shows that what led to his outcry stemmed from his sister's allegations of what she overheard in the home, which the victim in this case testified did not occur. So what led to the initial reaction by the family as to possibility of sexual assault, the victim in this case said that those events did not occur as his sister told them. However, a couple of days later, he then told people he had been raped. At trial on cross-examination, he testified he did not know what the word rape meant. However, he was able to testify as to the manner and means in which he alleges he was forcibly taken to the ground and sexual assault occurred. We do concede that these are credibility determinations. However, I think those insufficiencies that do exist in the record related to the allegations contained in the indictment are further at question or further questionable when we do consider the extraneous offenses that were improperly admitted as being untimely filed.
Can you jump to issue three and talk about?
Yes, Your Honor.
Give us your position there, just succinctly as you possibly can.
Yes, sir. As to the issue number three, it really appears to me that there's a kind of a split between some of the courts of appeals on how to treat the different ways of violating or committing the offense without consent, quote unquote, without consent being the quote the words at issue. The statute 22.011. B, subsection B contains approximately 14 different manners or means in which one could commit an assault. against ones without their consent. However, the indictment in this case merely stated that, or alleged, appellant had committed the offense against a disabled person without his consent. After the trial had, the evidence had all been before the court, and the jury charge was going, the jury charge defined three different manners and means by which they felt the evidence had proved would sustain a, without the consent of the victim in this case. One of those being subsection B4, which the actor knows that as a result of mental disease or defect, that they were unable to apprise the nature of the act or resist it. That they also allege threat of violence or violence itself. And when we look at the cases, a lot of the cases state that the state is not required to allege the manner and means in which they've committed, or the appellant is alleged to have committed the offense without consent. However, the court that we've relied on here, the San Antonio Court of Appeals in Castaneda Lerma, held that in doing so, that allowed the jury, some of the jurors could have found that this victim in this case did not have the ability mentally to understand the nature of the act that was occurring or to resist it. But the Court of Appeals in that case was worried, but other juries could have very well found he was of the mental capacity to understand these, but then he was overtaken by something different. The Court of Appeals in San Antonio found that that lessened the state's burden. Some of the jurors would be able to rule on mental capacity in one way, while others are ruling on mental capacity in another way. I think that the fact that this is a aggravated sexual assault alleged against a disabled person is what makes that important when we start alleging yet another mental capacity factor to the analysis, but also alleging that he could or could not mentally understand what was happening. These are very big different factors that I think could make a verdict not unanimous.
I mean, it's a general rule. State doesn't have to allege manner and means. Would you agree with that? I mean, I think that's what Floyd said, the Court of Criminal Appeals recently.
Yes, the Court of Criminal Appeals, in a lot of these cases, the courts of appeals that have dealt with the specific subsections at issue have relied upon Court of Criminal Appeals cases relating to the manner and means as it applies to primarily theft cases. And the cases from the Court of Criminal Appeals often state that, you're not required to allege the manner and means in those theft cases. But that when a defense attorney does request, they can do a motion to quash based upon notice and limit the state down to what they are actually relying on prior to trial. And that's another notation that we would just like to point out here, considering that the statute contains 14 different ways. That's a lot. We're not talking about a statute that gives you two or three different things, and we're pretty much on notice that it's going to be one of these few things. We have a list of 14 that a defense counsel is, according to the law, should be prepared to defend against without any notice as to which section they're relying upon.
Well, that's my question. If the general rule is the state doesn't have to allege manner and means, but you say in this case they do, where are we supposed to draw the line?
I do understand your point. I think it's complicated. I think the line in this case, if we look at Castaneda versus Lerma, is more focused on subsection B4 and the allegations of mental understanding of the allegations, or not the allegations, of appraising or apprising this, the nature of the act and being able to resist it, is just so hand in hand, or it is at odds with some of the other factors that are covered by subsection 4. And I think that that specific subsection, by its reference to the mental capacity of the alleged victims, is what makes this case different when we're talking about someone that we've already alleged is a disabled person. And I think that that primarily is the difference. I do believe, however, that the statute has this specific statute. I cannot find a case on from the Court of Criminal Appeals telling us that that is exactly what we should do in these cases. A lot of the cases that are saying that the manner and means is sufficient without alleging one of the 14 subsections in the statute, has primarily been decided in the Amarillo Courts of Appeals and some Houston Courts of Appeals as well, and then we have San Antonio on the other end. I do believe this is a confusing statute, and I think it's a confusing statute for the very purpose that we're talking about 14 different subsections that could apply, and how great and wide that defense is, that unknown, for an attorney to prepare in such an important case as the allegations that are contained in this, and especially when we're looking at supplemental notice of these extraneous offenses being then filed only one day prior to trial. So not only was counsel left with this last-minute, untimely filed notice, but they were also left to defend against approximately 14 different manners and means without any notice restricting it. The only way you would be able to restrict that for counsel to be prepared is to look at the notice that had been provided, but because it was untimely, we would argue that that was unavailable in this case. I see I'm out of time. Thank you so much.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Jeff Schell. I am here as a special prosecutor at the request of the Wise County Criminal District Attorney's Office and its elected Criminal District Attorney, James Stanton. Just by way of explanation, oftentimes small district attorney's offices in various parts of the state of Texas oftentimes themselves restricted by resources or other means to not be able to hire or keep a full-time appellate prosecutor. And that is what I do in Rockwall County. That is what I do not only in the capacity of an appellate prosecutor, but I also have my own financial crimes division to keep up with. So oftentimes I'm asked to appear on behalf of other district attorney's offices, and that's why I'm here. It's been since 2006, January 24th specifically, I had to look it up, since I was last here in the Fort Worth court, and it's an honor and a privilege to be back. With that being said, I'm going to take the issues in the order. I know that counsel probably did not intend to waive the second issue on appeal as it relates to the mistrial. She may cover that in rebuttal to the extent that it's necessary. Let me just briefly say that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying a mistrial. Article 36.22 of the Code of Criminal Procedure refers to while deliberations are being taken place, and I think that whatever communication there was with this particular jury occurred before deliberations were even taking place. So not only is there not a violation of Article 36.22, but there was a very sparse record in this case, and the trial court simply did not abuse its discretion in declaring a mistrial. I'll let that argument stand. As to the sufficiency of the evidence, the point of error, the issue is convoluted in some extent. It confuses the issue of notice and the issue of sufficiency of the evidence. And just to that point, I think that it's important to point out that this supplemental notice that was provided a day before trial was not the only notice of extraneous offenses. In fact, the state had provided an original notice much sooner. It provided its original notice on October 3rd of 2023, and the supplemental notice came on November 13th of 2023. So to say that somehow the defense didn't have notice is not necessarily true. They had notice well before trial. The state simply issued a supplemental notice a day before, and there was no issue that was raised as to that supplemental notice. So the argument in that regard has been waived. As for the standard of review, to Justice Basil's point, if this court finds the evidence is sufficient, then I do think it does away with the first issue on appeal. And in large part because the standard of review, as this court well knows, includes both the validly admitted evidence as well as any inadmissible evidence. So if there was no objection to the inadmissible evidence, then there can be no parameters for this court to not consider it. So the evidence is sufficient, and the issue of notice was either waived or not sufficiently addressed in the trial court. Let me go straight to the jury charge error in this case. That is the last issue on appeal for the appellant. She made the argument that there was a split between the Court of Appeals as to the words without consent. We cited in our brief the Fongang opinion out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals, which addressed this situation and held that there was no jury charge error. There's also no jury charge error here because, and I don't think this court can make that fine line distinction between how to treat this type of an aggravated sexual assault and some other type of aggravated assault. If that was to be the case, then we'd be applying due process principles that apply to disabled individuals as opposed to someone else. And the statute is written in a way that specifies those 14 type subsections of the offense. And the indictment itself, it's on the clerk's record, page 10, just simply alleges without the consent of the complainant.
In count one,
yes. But it's also as to count two, both counts. And for that reason, if there was an issue with the indictment, if defense counsel had chosen to file a motion to quash or perhaps had some other type of hearing before the trial court to ask for more specific allegations, that certainly could have been done, but it wasn't in this case. And so the trial court is left in a position where the trial judge has to hear the evidence as it develops during the trial and then determine which one of those 14 subsections applies. And in this case, as we've set forth in our brief, the trial court decided to submit in the jury charge subsection 1, subsection 2, and subsection 4. And the trial court has to have the discretion to be able to do that because the trial court's in the best position to hear the evidence, consider the credibility of the witnesses, and determine whether or not the jury is given sufficient instructions to find a verdict or to reach a verdict. And so under the circumstances, the state's position is there is no jury charge error here. There is no jury charge error because the trial judge is in the best position to listen to the evidence and apply which subsection fits that case. And if we decide to impose a different type rule, then we're basically constricting our trial courts in the state of Texas to just what may or may not have been argued before the case went to trial. This all could have been addressed before trial, and it simply wasn't. And so when the court has now heard all the evidence, the charge conference takes place, and the defense attorney makes the appropriate objection to the charge, he says, well, subsection 4 should not be included. And the trial judge has heard all of the evidence and already in the exercise of his reasonable discretion, determined that it should be submitted, and he does so. And as for the other two subsections, the evidence supported both of those subsections as well. So this isn't a confusing statute. Of the 14 subsections, only three were used by the trial court judge. It's not like he created a jury charge and then included all 14. That's not what he did. This judge decided, based on what he heard and based on what the evidence was adduced, decided that subsections 1, subsection 2, and subsection 4 were the applicable subsections to this specific case and applied them. And there simply is no jury charge error in that regard. Even if you assume that there is some type of error, there isn't any allegation of any harm that establishes how this appellant and his conduct was inconsistent with subsections B1, B2, or B4. So no jury charge error, first of all. In the alternative, it's harmless.
Yeah, but you know, I think what the appellant is complaining about is not that there wasn't evidence that could potentially clue the judge into these three possibilities, but that the indictment was fixed and what was charged exceeded the scope of the indictment, I guess is the best way to put it. But it sounds like you've already basically at the beginning said that you don't think that's the case either, that it doesn't exceed the scope of what's delineated in the indictment.
Correct, sir. That's right.
And remind me again why that would be the case.
Okay. Here's why it's not the case. First of all, the statute does not say that the state must specify what without the consent means. It doesn't have to do that. But even if there was an argument that could be made for purposes of creating a hypothetically correct jury charge, that without the consent could have been, but in this case was not, addressed by some type of motion to quash.
Okay. So when he says in the indictment, just without the consent of.
Yes.
And then he comes back and he says, these are possibilities here. It's within the scope of that language.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. If the legislature wanted to address this situation, it could do so. It could have written the statute in a way that would have required the state in some kind of pretrial motion or in some kind of pretrial notice, some kind of document that would satisfy basic procedural due process. Mm-hmm. Could have specified that the state will, prior to any election or prior to any jury charge conference, or before the jury charge is read, that's probably the better answer under 3614 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. Before the jury charge was even read, then the state would have to provide some type of notice. It would be like making an election of some form or fashion if the statute was written that way, but it's not. So when it's silent, we can't presume what the legislature intended. We can't put into the statute things that are not there.
Counsel cites the San Antonio case.
Yes.
I assume she cites it accurately. I mean, do you agree that the holding is of the San Antonio case is what she says it is?
I think that, let me address it two ways. Number one, it's an unpublished opinion out of San Antonio. It's not necessarily binding on this court.
Understood.
Let's assume that it is persuasive. Then there is a potential conflict between appellate courts, between Amarillo, San Antonio, if you want to use it within the confines of how the state briefed this case. But I think that it still goes back to their argument that it somehow lessens the burden of proof on the state. The state still has to prove those three magic words without the consent. It's just that without the consent, in their viewpoint, is broader than what is necessary. But given the breadth of what the how the statute reads, there's also the requirement then that the trial court judge, who is responsible for the jury charge, then narrows that broadened view and narrows the broadened view to three very specific subsections.
You just think San Antonio got it wrong. It's okay.
It's my city of my law school. I St. Mary's doesn't get things wrong. No, I'm teasing.
Well, I grew up down there, and I saw a lot of things go wrong. But
there was a lot of things that I certainly did wrong in 3 years of law school at St. Mary's too. But having said that, and all kidding aside, potentially the court did get it wrong because perhaps there wasn't some St. Mary's grad from 1991 that was in San Antonio at the time to argue that this broad view of this specific statute could be narrowed to three specific subsections that are applicable in this case. And there is no argument that the evidence is contrary to those three subsections.
Now, if a judge charges a jury and in that charge, he or she takes away an element of the offense that had been asserted in the indictment, that's impermissible. You agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Federal law, that's constructive amendment. In state law, we have a different term for it, but essentially only the grand jury can do that.
Yes, sir.
You agree with that?
Absolutely.
And of course, that's kind of, I think, the umbrella in which appellant is operating here. And even the San Antonio case says if you allege one of several statutory methods of committing a crime, the law as authorized by the indictment is limited to the method specified in the indictment. Well, that was the De La Rosa case, but they cited it. Here in count one, it's a pretty general, just aggravated sexual assault, correct?
Yes,
in
sir.
In our case.
Yes, sir.
And so what you're saying is without the consent of, which is an element,
yes,
is not being taken away at all.
Correct.
But it's just simply the judge is taking the facts that he heard and then saying these are the different ways in which it could have been without the consent of. Which, because you don't have to actually specifically address the manner and means,
yes,
you say is not a problem.
Yes. That is exactly what the state is saying in this case.
And so in some ways, you may even say that you don't necessarily disagree with the San Antonio court. You could actually distinguish it.
I think it's distinguishable, yes. But it's distinguishable on the basis of, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record here, but it doesn't lessen the state's burden when the trial judge is basically telling the jury in its jury charge, and it's on page 111 of the clerk's record. The judge specifically sets forth aggravated sexual assault is without the consent of the other person if, one, the actor compels the other person to submit or participate by the use of physical force, violence, or coercion. That fits here. That fits the facts. He took him down to the ground and sexually assaulted him. Number two, the actor compels the other person to submit or participate by threatening to use force or violence against the other person or to cause harm to the other person, and the other person believes the actor has the present ability to execute the threat. There was some very specific testimony from this child victim that he was younger, he was smaller, and this defendant was much larger than he was. So I think that fits number two. And I'm just hitting the high points of the evidence.
Sure. And you don't have to move on, because I think we all see that.
Okay.
You worded another way, you could almost say that the judge was defining terms. He wasn't modifying elements of an offense.
Correct. He's simply taking the facts as he's heard them and considering the evidence as he's heard it and instructing the jury in an appropriate way so that it can render a true verdict. And I think that would be consistent with any approach of any aggravated sexual assault of a disabled person in the state of Texas. It's not an abuse of discretion. The trial court has to have the ability to charge the jury in a way that allows it to find a true verdict, and I think that's exactly what the trial court did here. I see that my time is just about to come to an end. Unless the court has any questions, I will give back only 15 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Opposing counsel says that the jury charge has to be written in a way to ensure that we get a correct verdict. Appellant would argue the indictment should be written in such a way to give the appellant due process notice of what he's being alleged to have committed, what offense he has been alleged to have committed and how in this case. In this case, primarily the indictment tells us that it was based upon his status as a disabled person, and the defense counsel could look at the state's initial notice of extraneous offenses as well to see what other sections could apply. However, in this case, we're stuck with, we have 14 different ones, 14 different subsections, and we have two different notices that came. And the big issue here is that notice was untimely, and a lot of the evidence that the judge relied upon in establishing the jury charge in this case was based upon evidence that we believe was untimely and incorrectly admitted at trial. However, we do believe that the appellant should have been entitled to notice in this case of what he was preparing for well before one day, well before trial. And I kind of agree with the beginning of what the state said, that maybe there are different things that the legislature could have done, such as a pretrial notice or action that's required to satisfy due process by limiting the manner and means prior to trial. I think the state then said, or prior to the jury charge, based upon the evidence that was introduced. But I think that step back kind of shows the problem for the defense attorney. The state would argue that the appropriate time to discuss what applies is after we've heard all of the evidence. At that point, the defendant's hands are tied. He's already completed a trial.
But wasn't the objection at trial and your issue on appeal not about what was lacking in the indictment? It was about the language that was going into the jury charge. Am I correct about
that? You are correct, Your Honor. The objection was primarily based on B4 being included in the jury charge. And we do believe that.
And I mean, I understand in issue one, you're kind of, because you have your limitations, you're kind of putting this notice issue in that issue. And that's one of the reasons it kind of seems murky, is because you're trying to do things that you have limitations on. But when it comes to this issue three, we're looking at the charge. And what you are saying is lacking there, or is wrong there, really.
Yes, and again, as appellant argued in the brief, we rely on the San Antonio Court of Appeal. I will note to Justice Walker that your questions about whether it should be distinguishable was a question that you had posed to the state. I believe that it is distinguishable to an extent that the indictment in that case did allege one of the subsections, and then the jury charge in that case sought to add additional. However, in this case, the harm is about the same based upon the actions. Although the actions of the court are different, the harm is the same. Because here, we're moving forward with no notice of what's been done and then adding additional things at the end and limiting it to what the judge believed was appropriate at that point. But when you're looking at the harm, when you've made the objection that this is not legally should be included in this jury charge and it's not corroborated or by the record, or we were given untimely notice, whatever the issue is, we then have to look at the harm that is suffered as a result, if in fact it was erroneous.
Let me ask you this. So your position is not that the judge added an element or took away an element. Is that, you agree with that? I know you're saying that he lessened the burden, but you're not making that argument, are you?
I don't believe it extended the burden of the state whatsoever. The state's roadmap was wide open when they walked into the trial. And so at that point, they had 14 things to choose from those 2 to 3 days of trial to try to hit as many as they could against a defense attorney who was not prepared with adequate notice as to what he was defending against. And quickly, as to that second motion for new trial issue, I'd just like to put on the record that objection should have been, other things could have been done by counsel. I think that would have preserved the issue better for appellate purposes. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you. Counselors, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been helpful. Your case has now been submitted, and you're free to go. Thank you.